KFI AM 640. Bill Handel here on January 24. It is a Tuesday. Okay, a couple things I want to talk about. First of all, for some reason, there's conversation again about California receding from the United States and establishing its own country. Now, on its face, you know, I mean, it does make sense in terms of population, 38 million, in terms of its economy. I mean, it's a juggernaut. I think it's the sixth largest economy in the world, which makes it already a nation state. But the problem with this argument about secession is that California happens to be part of a little thing we call the United States of America. And a couple of states tried that once back in 1860, and it didn't look very good. It really didn't. So, but I have to tell you, a lot of people in California are going that. I mean, it's 32% now support it. One in three support secession, which is a lot higher than last time in 2014 when it was one in five. And that was right around the time that Scotland held its independence referendum to break away from the UK, and Scotland voted to stay, remain in the United Kingdom. So California is way at the top of the heap about seceding from the union. Matter of fact, it even has earned a sort of a catchy name, Calexit. Everything is exit now. Even exits are exits. And during the campaign, here's what had happened, is since this is a very heavily Democratic state, Trump alienated a lot of Democrats, which means a lot of Californians, with his promise to crack down on the illegal immigration, creating a Muslim registry, remarks about women that were found very offensive by women and Democrats, liberals, vows to repeal the Affordable Care Act. All of these issues in which Americans, Californians, feel on the other side of Donald Trump. So is this going to happen? Of course not. And I don't even know why people do this. If you secede, you're going to go to war. What do you think happens? You think that the United States just lets someone bail out? Look at history. And then if California secedes, the California National – well, no, the National Guard is under the feds. So what are the state police? I think the only one is the Highway Patrol that is armed. I don't know. There's other states, police agencies, but – still, I mean, good. You guys fight with the Army. All right, now let's get to a little bit more important, and that's the death of the TPP. That is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, first of all, let's start with Donald Trump yesterday signing executive order, pulling us out of negotiations of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let me start with, it really didn't mean a lot practically because it really had no chance of passing the Senate anyway. I mean, the president, President Obama, has been going for this for years. As a matter of fact, there's only one country that's actually ratified this out of 12 of the 12 countries involved. And I think that's Japan. So it was dead on arrival anyway. And the president didn't have to do anything. And it still wouldn't have passed, and we still would never have entered into the partnership. However, what a president does, what he says, and is the symbolism of what he does is one of the vastly important aspects of being president. It's not only the bully pulpit, but also establishing a course of which America is going to follow. So yesterday, his executive order saying we're out of the TPP, in fact, was hugely important because it told the world, it told Americans that we are going on this protectionist, half isolationist financial view, economic view of this country vis-a-vis everybody else. And so, okay, now let's talk about what the TPP means. All right. We know it's a partnership. There's 12 countries that are in North America, right? portions of South America, Southeast Asia, and Japan. And the whole point of getting rid of or not engaging in the TPP was to keep American jobs. Absolutely. Because if we don't have trade deals with these other countries, which makes it easier for us to buy products from other countries, that means we're more apt to buy American products, which means more people are employed in America manufacturing the goods that maybe we would have bought overseas. Because this, we're throwing tariffs up, we're just making it more difficult. All right, fair enough. So is it that one-sided? All right, let's talk about that for a moment. It's just jobs. And on its face, you know, that makes a fair amount of sense. If it's going to be easier to buy products, Americans to buy products here in the United States, made by Americans, cheaper, easier than it is now, then it's all good. It's all upside. Now, is there any downside to this? Oh, you betcha. And you know who's going to get nailed the most on the withdrawal from the TPP? What part of the country? Yep, right here in California. Oh, yeah, it's going to cost us big time. It's going to help the manufacturing. It's going to help the Rust Belt, guaranteed. But it's not going to help us. And I'll explain why and what it means. And then a little bit in depth of TPP, which we haven't been talking about. And I'm going to come back with that. KFI AM 640.
KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk.
I know I can treat you better than he can, and any girl like you did.
KFI AM 640. Bill Handel here, January 24. It is Tuesday, and more on the TPP. Yesterday, the president signed an executive order officially canceling our negotiations with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, 12 countries around the Pacific Rim that were negotiating sort of a European Union deal, sort of a free trade agreement where there are no barriers and no tariffs and that sort of thing. A couple of things, practical things. It wasn't going to pass anyway. Okay, it was dead on arrival. Senate never would have passed it. And as a matter of fact, this whole thing is just negotiations because only one country has ratified it. But in terms of symbolism and what it does and what it would do, here's the problem with the TPP either working or not working. By us, that is the United States, making sure there really is no free trade back and forth, although it's effectively that way anyway. But let's see who's hurt by it, okay? We know that the Rust Belt is really helped by not getting involved in the TPP. And that is tariffs can be instituted because there's no agreement. And that means that it's more expensive to buy from overseas because there are no more restrictions put on it. So that means American workers are going to be producing more products. If it costs money to bring in a Toyota more than it costs now, then hopefully American cars will be built here, even Toyotas, because they're going to have to build plants here. But who gets hurt? I'll tell you who gets hurt. California gets hurt. Because if you have fewer goods moving into this country from overseas, what happens? Well, the ports aren't doing as much business. And you know how big the ports of L.A. and Los Angeles are? I mean, Long Beach and L.A., are those the busiest ports in the world? Damn close. Maybe Rotterdam and a few other places, but it is astounding how much business comes through the ports, the shipping. And if we're going to curtail that, well, you know, people are going to lose jobs. And then you have the warehouse workers. Then you have the truck drivers. And then you have the people that support. And then all the importers. Now, how many people, how many stores, how many businesses rely on imports from China, for example? They're all going to be hurt. Now, we really don't know the numbers until all of this pans out. And really, in the end, it's not going to change a whole lot anyway. Because in reality, all of our treaties and agreements are already in place. Nothing's going to really change. Had we ratified the TPP, how much changes? Not a whole lot. So here's the problem. For a trade deal to have a major impact, It has to change the entire dynamics with a market that was closed but then opens. Not these minor little changes. When's the last time that happened? Well, when China joined the entire world trading system. Boy, that changed everything, didn't it? That was a seismic shift. When China entered the world market and started selling like crazy. So what's going on? First of all, we already do engage in trade with the TPP countries. And the whole point of this was to have this sort of central agreement, long-term U.S. interests, and what is supposed to happen with the TPP is to engineer a single interlocking trade system, much like what happened in Europe. But here's two of the problems. Problem number one is modern products are no longer made in one country. They're made in all kinds of different countries. So it makes sense to have an integral integrated system where goods move back and forth because they're moving back and forth anyway. So why start throwing tariffs up? That's just one part of it. And they require stable, predictable international supply change, supply chains of which the TPP would help ensure or create more of. But in terms of the financial hit on the U.S. economy, the TPP, either yay or nay, doesn't even, it's not a drop in the bucket compared to a 5 cents a barrel click in oil or a dollar more per barrel in oil or interest rates going up half a point. Those have far, far more influence than what the TPP means. So the bottom line, some people are going to be helped. You bet. And this is Donald Trump's base. Donald Trump, and I'm willing to bet, was not a huge fan of the importers, the shippers, certainly the Rust Belt, because that's who he went after and that's who he got. That is his hardcore base. So the rest of us, not so much. And so either way, it's not the biggest deal in the world. However, it is the biggest deal in the world in terms of Donald Trump establishing the course of the United States. Just keep on reminding ourselves is that what the president says and does, even though there is no practical meaning to it, there really isn't a whole lot of effect. But what he says and does is extraordinarily important, not only here, but of course around the world, which is why this president is so strange, because he does and says just the weirdest thing. Yesterday, he started rehashing the election again in a private meeting with the leadership of Congress and the Senate. I mean, the first 10 minutes was rehashing winning and saying that he would have won the general election had not 3 to 4 million illegal aliens voted. And they had, what? Where'd he come up with this? It doesn't matter where I came up with it. I wonder what the leadership does. I have to ask John this next time. When they hear stuff like this, does it just go over their head? Do they tisk, tisk, oh, that's just our president. Now, he really doesn't mean it. He really doesn't believe it. Although it wasn't for public consumption. It was among the leadership of Congress. Go figure.
So, by the way, Paul Ryan did invite President Trump to speak to a joint session of Congress next month.
So that's going to be
kind of a pseudo State of the Union.
Right, that's in lieu of the pseudo State. Michelle did some research on this, and I thought a State of the Union is mandatory every year, and it's not. The Constitution says from time to time.
Yeah, he doesn't have to give one really ever in his presidency. He's already addressed the country in his inaugural.
Yeah, and he can give a one-sentence State of the Union.
Here's your update. Yeah.
The State of the Union is strong. Thank you very much. Thank you. Don't forget to tip the waiters on the way out.
And the
veal is great today. What?
The Senate committee hearing Ben Carson's appointment or nomination has approved Ben Carson for housing secretary.
Right. Shocker of all shockers. Okay. Coming up, Oscar nominations. We're going to talk about those, and we're going to check in with Jason Nathanson, who is the entertainment reporter for ABC News. KFI AM 640.
We see more stimulating talk in your future. That future starts now. KFI, an iHeartRadio station.
I'm in deep with this girl, but she's out of my mind.
KFI AM 640. Bill Handel here, January 24th on a Tuesday. And amongst the big news this morning, since this is a company town in terms of showbiz, the Oscar nominations are bigger news here than any place else. So with us is Jason Nathanson, who is the entertainment reporter for ABC News. And Jason, thank you so much for joining us. Hey, the biggest question, of course, since it was all white nominations last year, how's it going in this year with the minorities?
It's not so white. They reversed themselves. We've got all different kinds of flavors, colors, shapes, sizes, whatever you want. In all the supporting or all the acting categories and the directing category, you have a person of color, at least one person of color nominated. So I don't know if we're going to hear that same kind of outcry.
Oh, of course not. And you immediately comes to mind, you wonder how much of this was politically correct. Not in the sense of let me ask you this. Right. Do you think, and there's a buzz, I can't ask your opinion because I know you're a reporter, but is there a buzz out there that nominations that otherwise would not have happened were because it was so important to the Academy to bring minorities into the picture?
I don't know about this year. If you look at the people who were nominated, like Viola Davis or Denzel Washington, Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, those are all people who would have been nominated any year. It wouldn't have mattered. They weren't token nominations for this year.
Well, why not last year? Because there were some minority performances that were phenomenal last year.
There were, and that's the question. Was this some kind of systemic racism that was inherent in the Academy or in other bodies? And so they made moves to change that this year with a more diverse membership that they included. And maybe there's changes. Maybe those past couple of years just didn't have enough performances that there could be something that broke through. I think more importantly, it's a bigger problem in Hollywood with films getting made and people of color or women behind the director's chairs and things like that. That's more the problem. It's just the sheer number of people and roles that were available for nominations maybe weren't there in the past couple of years, and this year there's just more of them.
I was talking to someone in the film business, and the problem is, since international sales are so enormous and are such an important part of the business end of movies, actually far more than even a domestic box office today.
Sure.
The reality is that minority films simply do not sell overseas, anywhere near as well. And that becomes a real problem for minority involvement in the film industry.
It does. I mean, you know, you take a film like Moonlight, it's not going to play big in China. That's really not what they're going to be watching. But for every, you know, Deadpool or Finding Dory or Rogue One or those big films that do well overseas, the studios still want to make those prestige films that get nominated for the Oscars. They don't really care so much about those films doing well at the box office overseas or even really doing well at the box office here. Some of them do well, but, you know, Hidden Figures is one of the ones that's doing really well at the box office when it comes to the Best Picture nominees, but most of the other ones aren't making a whole lot of money. Fences isn't, you know, a blockbuster. But you want that prestige. You want Oscar nominations. So they'll keep producing those films.
And I'm assuming the easiest way of dealing with creating a lot of minority films is simply keeping them as low budget as you can possibly do and still create a fairly profitable film.
Right. Don't give minorities any money to make actually.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reality.
Films.
Unfortunately, that's the reality. And then the problem becomes in terms of the minority, and that's why it was so weird last year, the minority involvement in films. There are so many films out there and performances created by so many people. half of them could vie for Academy Award nominations.
But it's not just about minority. Like, you take a film like Manchester by the Sea. That has nothing to do with minorities. That's a small, small picture that's doing very, very well. And it doesn't have any, you know, you don't have to be just a minority film to do small box office. It's just these prestige films, I think, that do small box office. So
yeah, it's always Holocaust films always do very well.
Right.
And yeah, it's just weird the way it goes. All right. So let's talk about the list. I'm assuming no surprises other than La La Land getting 14 nominations. Did that come out of the blue?
No, it didn't come out of the blue. People were wondering if it was going to get 14. It might get 13, might get 14. 14 is the record. It actually ties the record for set by All About Eve, I think, in 1950, and Titanic in 1997. So it's up there in the rare pantheon of films to get 14 nominations. And then, you know, looking over, there are some surprises. No huge surprises in the acting category. You know, if you want to call Arrival, that was the second most nominated film with 8, but Amy Adams did not get an acting nomination for that. Arrival actually getting no acting nominations. So that's a little strange to give it so much love and then no acting nominations. The biggest surprise for me actually has to be in the animated feature category. Finding Dory, the biggest animated feature of the year, not nominated for that. It was critically acclaimed. It did really well at the box office all around the world, but it couldn't get a nomination. Something called My Life as a Zucchini got a nomination instead. Have not seen that one. I don't know if I will. You know, acting-wise, it's some of those, like, you know, a lot of people thought Tom Hanks should get in for Sully, but a lot of people also thought, you know, wasn't really that big of a film. It wasn't really that good.
It wasn't. It wasn't a pilot over the Holocaust.
No.
So
had he done that, yeah. Perhaps with a plane full of all minority passengers on there.
Absolutely. So, in terms of the betting right now, right? Las Vegas. You go to the book in Las Vegas. Best director, best picture, best leading role, actress, actor.
Okay, so you got to go La La Land definitely for best actor, or for best picture. That's definitely the one that's in the lead right now, with maybe a Moonlight or a Manchester by the Sea there. For best supporting actress, you got to go with Viola Davis in Fences. She's been winning so far, and she's probably the one. Director, probably going to go to Damien Chazelle for La La Land. That's an interesting category, though, if you want to look at interesting surprises there. Mel Gibson getting in for Hacksaw Ridge. I mean, you know, talk about a guy who was ostracized by Hollywood for years, hasn't been in the conversation. They let him out of Hollywood jail. So, you know, they're letting him back in the club. For lead actress, probably going to go with Emma Stone for La La Land. Although Isabelle Huppert did well at the Golden Globes, but no, Emma Stone wasn't in her category. So, then lead actor, Casey Affleck for Manchester by the Sea. That's pretty much a lock.
Yep. Okay. Good stuff. We'll talk again as this thing continues on. Thank you, sir. Jason?
Anytime.
All
Take
right.
care.
All right. Jason Nathanson of ABC, ABC News reporter, actually entertainment reporter. Coming up, who is our new CIA director? A little bit about Mike Pompeo. And I was kind of surprised at the huge controversy here, and I'll share that story with you. KFI AM 640.
KFI AM 640. More stimulating talk.
KFI handle here. Oh, little froggy. January 24th on a Tuesday. All right, last night, the nomination was confirmed. The Senate did confirm Mike Pompeo as CIA director, which I thought was a pretty cheap shot by the Senate Democrats. Because when the president met with the CIA, he did not bring along his new CIA director to introduce him, because Mike Pompeo had not yet been confirmed, but everybody knew he was going to be confirmed. I mean, there was no issue. And he sailed through. So yesterday, the Senate did confirm Mike Pompeo. Vote was 66-32. Some Democrats, I mean, actually it was all Democrat nay, with one Republican in opposition, just one, Senator Rand Paul. And even then, the senators were actually given an extra time to get their vote in because the weather was so crazy. And the vice president, Mike Pence, swore in Pompeo at the White House. And so let's talk about who he is. And one of the things that Donald Trump has done, and I think most presidents do this, when they bring someone to the table as a nominee for a cabinet post, usually that person is either fairly qualified or very qualified. And I would put Mike Pompeo as in very qualified. That's just my take on it. The only one who I think is totally unqualified is Ben Carson. And Ben Carson as HUD secretary, who also is confirmed, that was a straight loyalty call. That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. I can't imagine for a moment that President Trump doesn't think that there are dozens, if not hundreds, of people that are more qualified to be the HUD secretary. But Mike Pompeo, he's, you know, it was a good choice. You may not like his politics, but it's not up to the Senate to confirm or deny based on politics. Although, of course, that's what they do day in and day out. It's based on, is that person qualified, yay or nay? He was born in Orange, California, so he's a Southern California guy. He attended the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, majoring in mechanical engineering, graduating first in his class in 1986. That is not easy to do, not by a long shot. And then served as an armor branch cavalry officer, and he was a patrol of the Iron Curtain. He was up on in Western Europe before the fall of the Berlin Wall. He was one of those guys in Western Europe. And then he also served in the 2nd Squadron, 7th Cavalry. I mean, we have to go to that. And then after leaving active duty, he graduates. He goes to Harvard Law School and graduates, where he was an editor of the Harvard Law Review. Here we go again. This is pretty rarefied air. You have to be real smart to get there. And he then worked as a private lawyer for one of the bigger firms. And then he later moves back to South Central Kansas, where his mother's family was born. And he founds a company called Thayer Aerospace, hugely successful. And he was the CEO for more than 10 years, providing idea consulting for commercial and military aircraft. And then he became president of Century International, an oil field equipment manufacturing distribution service company. So he has some great experience, not only academically, but also as an entrepreneur and a manager. His administrative abilities are strong. So now let's talk about the CIA and the intelligence community. He was on the Energy and Commerce Committee, overseeing energy, healthcare, manufacturing, telecommunication. His one connection to the intelligence community is he was on the House Intelligence Committee. In 2010, he became a fourth-term congressman from Kansas. He was appointed to the House Select Benghazi Committee to investigate what happened in Benghazi, Libya, which was insanely political. I mean, that was more political than almost anything. And as a congressman, his main objective is freeing private enterprise. He's a very private enterprise kind of guy, and defending constitutional rights. So he's a strict constructionist, too. He's rather conservative. And then there's a whole debate that he's been at the center of, fiscal responsibility and halting what he says is regulatory overreach. And that's particularly agricultural and reducing imposition of burdens, entrepreneurs and small business. He's a small business guy. He's pro-small business and against government intervention. And before casting their vote, the Senate Minority Whip, John Cornyn, said, "I just want to remind our colleagues that our country continues to face incredible threats and they're not hitting the pause button. And the president needs his national security cabinet and particularly a CIA director at his side. And it's a position integral to keeping our country safe." So the problem that a lot of Democrats have is his view on electronic surveillance and torture. Because last week he told Congress in the hearings he would consider bringing back waterboarding and other, quote, enhanced interrogation measures. Now, does that Considering that, does that make him unqualified? I think that's going a little too far. I do. Because I guess you have to be adamantly opposed under all circumstances. And otherwise, you're not qualified to be the CIA director. So in the end, his qualifications are not as strong as someone who's been in the intelligence community one's entire career. He's got pretty good credentials outside of that. Now, is that enough to make him a good CIA director? I don't know. The argument is to bring in an outsider. And a lot of people have said that's what we have a president who's an outsider. And does that change anything? We have a director of HUD who is an outsider and has no experience in government whatsoever. And I think that only flies for presidents. I think everybody else has to have some experience, don't you think? All right, coming up, Dr. Keeney has some details, is going to ask us a question. Is burnt toast and roasted potatoes going to kill you because you're going to have a galloping cancer as soon as you eat a piece of burnt toast? And the answer may very well be yes. KFI AM 640.